Hi, this is Evan Karish, Editor-in-Chief of Anesthesiology, with some highlights from the April 2018 issue as selected by the journal editors. Of special note this month, anesthesiology features two comprehensive review articles and three accompanying editorials on the evidence for anesthetic developmental neurotoxicity in animals and in humans, following the FDA's 2016 safety announcement and its 2017 drug labeling requirements related to these same topics. But first, we begin with a clinical investigation, which looks at the use of lung ultrasound as an emerging tool in perioperative care. Dr. In-Kyung Song of the University of Ulsan College of Medicine in Seoul and colleagues there and elsewhere in Korea conducted a randomized, controlled trial to assess the utility of perioperative lung ultrasound examination in pediatric cardiac surgery. They assigned children aged 5 or younger undergoing cardiac surgery into either a control group or an intervention group. The control group received lung ultrasound examinations at the end of surgery and 6 to 12 hours postoperatively. The intervention group received lung ultrasound examinations and ultrasound-guided recruitment maneuvers, depending upon ultrasound findings, after inducing anesthesia, at the end of surgery, and at 6 to 12 hours postoperatively. The primary outcomes were the incidences of intra- and postoperative desaturation and postoperative pulmonary complications. Of the 120 children included in the analysis, postoperative desaturation occurred in nearly two-thirds of the control group, compared to just over 25% of the experimental group. The incidences of intraoperative desaturation and postoperative pulmonary complications were similar between the groups. Lung ultrasound scores were better in the intervention group than in the control group. The authors concluded that perioperative lung ultrasound examination, followed by ultrasound-guided recruitment maneuvers, decreases postoperative desaturation events and shortened the duration of mechanical ventilation in pediatric cardiac surgery patients. Next, we look at prolonged catheter use in neuraxial and regional anesthesia. This is controversial because of the risk of catheter-related infections. The extent to which the risk increases over time that a catheter remains in place is unknown. Dr. Hagen Bomberg of Saarland University in Hamburg, Saar, and colleagues there and elsewhere in Germany assessed the time dependence of catheter-related infection risk up to 15 days. They based their analysis on the German Network for Regional Anesthesia. They considered 44,000 patients who had surgery between 2007 and 2014 and had continuous regional anesthesia, as well as complete covariate details available. The authors performed Cox regression analysis and adjusted for confounding covariables to examine the relationship between catheter duration and the probability of infection-free catheter use. After adjustment for confounding factors, the relative frequency of infection-free catheter use decreased with each day of peripheral and epidural catheter use. In peripheral catheters, it was 99% at day 4 of catheter duration, 96% at day 7, and 73% at day 15. In epidural catheters, it was 99% at day 4 of catheter duration, 95% at day 7, and 73% at day 15. The authors concluded that infection risk among catheterized patients increases over time, especially after 4 days, and that infected catheters should be removed as soon as practical. Our next clinical investigation studied acute kidney injury. Acute kidney injury is a common complication after cardiac surgery with cardiopulmonary bypass. Animal studies have suggested that cyclosporin may be protective against kidney injury. Dr. Per Ederoth of Lund University in Lund, Sweden, and colleagues there tested the hypothesis that administering cyclosporin before extracorporeal circulation could protect the kidneys in patients undergoing cardiac surgery. They conducted a double-blind, randomized, placebo-controlled, single-center trial. The primary objective was to assess if cyclosporin could reduce acute kidney injury in patients undergoing coronary artery bypass graft surgery with extracorporeal circulation. They enrolled 154 patients and randomized them to receive either 2.5 milligrams per kilogram cyclosporin or placebo intravenously before surgery. The primary endpoint is a marker of renal injury, was the relative change in plasma cystatin C from the preoperative day to postoperative day 3. Secondary endpoints included biomarkers of heart and brain injury. Rather than protecting against renal injury, the group receiving cyclosporin showed a more pronounced increase from baseline to day 3 in plasma cystatin C compared to placebo. The same pattern was observed for other renal markers. The investigators concluded that cyclosporin does not reduce the risk of acute renal injury after cardiac surgery. Our next clinical investigation also pertains to cardiac surgery. We know that beta amyloid deposition is associated with Alzheimer's disease, and that anesthesia in animals has been associated with increases in brain beta amyloid. But it is unclear whether cardiac surgery and anesthesia are associated with changes in beta amyloid in humans. Dr. Rebecca Klinger and colleagues at Duke University tested the hypothesis that global cortical amyloid burden, determined by 18-fluoride fluorobetapore positron emission tomography, would be greater in those patients with cognitive dysfunction than those without cognitive dysfunction at 6 weeks postoperatively. In this prospective clinical study involving 40 patients undergoing cardiopulmonary bypass, the investigators evaluated amyloid deposition at 6 weeks. They also assessed neurocognitive function at baseline, and then at 6 weeks, 1 year, and 3 years. The investigators also evaluated differences between the surgical cohort with cognitive deficit and the Alzheimer's Disease Neuroimaging Initiative cohort. They found that 6 weeks abnormal global cortical amyloid deposition was not associated with postoperative cognitive dysfunction. On secondary analysis, beta amyloid deposition, specifically in the hippocampus, appeared to be increased 6 weeks after cardiac surgery in patients with postoperative cognitive deficits when compared to those without cognitive deficits. However, these changes were not statistically significant after adjustment. The authors concluded that postoperative cognitive dysfunction was not associated with 6-week global cortical amyloid deposition. For maintenance of labor analgesia, programmed intermittent boluses of local anesthetic have been shown to be superior to continuous infusions. Dr. Elizabeth Lang of Northwestern University Feinberg School of Medicine and colleagues there and at the University of Iowa tested the hypothesis that high-rate drug delivery would improve labor analgesia and reduce the requirement for provider-administered supplemental boluses for breakthrough pain. They designed a superiority, double-blind, randomized controlled trial in which nulliparous women with a singleton pregnancy at a cervical dilation of less than 5 centimeters at request for neuraxial analgesia were eligible. Neuraxial analgesia was initiated with intrathecal fentanyl 25 micrograms. The maintenance epidural solution was bupivacaine 0.625 milligrams per mil with fentanyl 1.95 micrograms per mil. Programmed intermittent boluses every 60 minutes and 10 milliliters and patient-controlled boluses, 5-milliliter bolus with a lockout interval of 10 minutes, were administered at a rate of 100 mils per hour or 300 mils per hour. The primary outcome was the percentage of patients requiring provider-administered supplemental bolus analgesia. The low-rate and high-rate groups contained approximately 100 women each. In the low-rate group, 44 patients requested provider-administered supplemental bolus, while 37 patients in the high-rate group requested supplemental bolus analgesia. There was no difference between groups for the patient requested and delivered epidural bolus ratio and the hourly bupivacaine consumption. The authors concluded that programmed high-rate epidural injections do not appear superior to low-rate epidural injections. Our next investigation is a laboratory study in rats examining the mechanism by which steroids exert their effects. Corticosteroids are believed to exert their effects primarily through cytosolic receptors, which then act through classical genomic pathways in the nucleus. But recently, effects mediated by membrane-localized corticosteroid receptors have been identified. In rats, corticosteroids activate membrane-bound glucocorticoid and mineralocorticoid receptors in spinal cord and peripheral neurons, and modulate nociceptive behavior by non-genomic mechanisms. Zhongwan Li of Charité University Berlin and German and Japanese colleagues investigated inflammation-induced changes in neuronal versus glial glucocorticoid and mineralocorticoid receptors and the effects of steroids on mechanical nociception in rats. They examine glucocorticoid and mineralocorticoid receptor expression in spinal cord and peripheral sensory neurons versus glial cells in rats with hind paw inflammation caused by Freund's complete adjuvant. They found that hind paw inflammation resulted in 60% upregulation of glucocorticoid receptors in nociceptive neurons in spinal cord and 15% upregulation in dorsal root ganglia. Corticosteroid plasma concentrations remained unchanged. The investigators also explored the nociceptive behavioral changes following application of glucocorticoid and mineralocorticoid receptor agonists or antagonists. Glucocorticoid receptor agonist dexamethasone or mineralocorticoid receptor antagonist dose-dependently attenuated nociceptive behavior. The authors concluded that glucocorticoid and mineralocorticoid steroid receptor expression in spinal cord and peripheral sensory neurons is upregulated following peripheral inflammation. Additionally, there are acute, non-genomic effects of steroids on nociception. Lastly, this month, we feature two review articles about the effect of exposure to anesthesia, or anesthesia and surgery, on the developing brain in neonates and children. This comes in relation to concerns and warnings issued by the United States Food and Drug Administration. In our first review, Dr. Vesna Yevtovic Todorovic of the University of Colorado School of Medicine authored an article focusing on experimental data in animals. A large body of evidence gathered from several mammalian species shows that there are effects of many anesthetics on the developing animal brain, specifically during critical stages of neuronal networks formation. The review focused on non-human primates and suggests that studies with monkeys confirm evidence in rodents. Potential disruptions of brain development are thought due to perturbations of normal neuronal and glial activity. Since undisturbed neuronal and glial activity and communication are important for neuronal circuit formation, anesthetics have been thought to be detrimental to normal neuronal and glial development, resulting in alterations in cognitive and socio-emotional behavioral development. In animals, single and repeated neonatal exposures cause morphological changes and functional impairments. These include neuronal and glial apoptotic damage, mitochondrial dysfunction, impaired synaptic transmission, and changes in behavioral and cognitive outcomes. The review concludes that currently, the relevance of the animal findings remains to be confirmed in humans. In the second review, Dr. Andrew Davidson of Royal Children's Hospital in Melbourne, Australia, and Dr. Lena Sun of Columbia University authored an article focusing on experimental and clinical evidence in humans. They note that human evidence is weak regarding any association between anesthesia exposure in early childhood and the increased risk of poor neurodevelopmental outcomes. And they cite increasing evidence that the risk is minimal with brief anesthetic exposures. Most, but not all, of the large population-based studies find evidence for associations between surgery in early childhood and slightly worse subsequent academic achievement or increased risk for a later diagnosis of a behavioral disability. There is some evidence for a greater association with multiple exposures. These results may be consistent with the preclinical data, but the possibility of confounding means the positive associations are weak evidence. There may be some evidence for a greater association with multiple exposures. Doctors Davidson and Son conclude that there is very little, if any, human evidence to support a recommendation that anesthesia and surgery at a particular age is either safe or unsafe. Thank you for joining me for this brief exploration of the exciting work being published in anesthesiology. I'll be back in a few weeks with highlights from the May issue.